My name is Michael Coates, and I'm the co-founder of two veteran-owned organisations. And these conversations are dedicated to supporting the crosshair where business meets the military. This episode is the one we talk about writing a book, and we're doing it with no one better. Geraint Jones is a former infantry soldier who served in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and is now a New York Times and Sunday Times best-selling writer. This is part of the Declassified Network, and this is the Forces Friendly podcast. Did you, as a kid, did you write in school?
I used to make up stories as a young kid, you know, like a really young kid. But I never used to enter competitions or any of that kind of stuff.
No. Was you creative, though, with your writing as a kid?
I think I've been creative with ideas always. Idea-wise, I think, yeah.
And what were you saying? Like, so as a youngster, what, primary school?
Primary school age, and before, like literally is like potty age, which was secondary school for me. I've apparently always been really creative with reading as well. I think is a big one. Maybe you might want to note. To note down. We're not recording this. I didn't realize you started recording. I would say.
So it's basically what I'm trying to get at is there was some creativity there, was there?
There was creativity there. I'm trying to think of what the age. My mum. So okay. Apparently, I used to have a problem with not getting off the potty because I'd just be reading so much. And I think that's a bit. I think the thing about writing, is that learning to write, I reckon, is as much about reading as it is about writing. So it's. I think it was more about the amount of books I used to consume rather than the amount of stories I tried to create.
But that didn't cross over into senior school then?
No, because you just get to do other things, don't you? Rugby and getting rejected by women.
So then leaving school, university.
Yep.
So
that said, the sixth form, university, the idea of going into the army as an infantry officer.
Yeah.
But then Iraq kicked off, and I just didn't want to do that anymore. I just wanted to be a squaddie, kick some doors in, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, like the writing thing wasn't even in my mind, to be honest, at that point, mate. Like writing wasn't in my mind at all. All I wanted to do as a teenager was just go into. Once I'd gone through my fast jet pilot phase and realised that wasn't going to happen, then I just wanted to go in the infantry. I just wasn't thinking about writing at all. Really.
Yeah. I mean, that side of life's really really well documented. You know, your book, your podcast as well. Like, there's loads of stuff going on, so we're not going to go into that too much. But you did keep a diary when you was in Afghanistan.
Yeah, kept a pretty detailed one. I filled up a couple of notebooks while I was out there. It's one of those things where when you're on tour, it's like the really interesting days are the ones that never really got like you had the least detail of, because you know, you're just too busy to write anything. And it's the days where there's not really much going on where you get time to sit down and write a lot. And inevitably, a lot of that would just be kind of complaining about things that were going on. And I think the best part of it was that if someone said anything that stuck out, whether that be a bit of banter or just something that stuck in my mind as, you know, being important, that was really helpful to get that down. You know, so that I had those things. And sometimes you read back, you know, some words directly out of somebody's mouth that you took down in the moment. And that can then almost like re-pulls you back into that moment. You know, it's like you're back in the room or back in the vehicle. So that was really useful. That was really useful. Like those journals. So like, you know, I was talking to our mutual, let's call him a friend, Sean Jones. We were talking to him about the book, and he was saying that it felt like if there's like an immediacy there, like you feel like you're, you know, like it was written last week. And in effect, it kind of was, because it was all, you know, it was all written from the journals, and they were, you know, the journals were taken at the time. And it's going to be a challenge to write about Iraq, because I don't have that kind of, you know, I don't have those journals from Iraq. I didn't do it there. It's just something I did in Afghanistan. It's probably something, I'm probably not the only person to be kicking myself about not keeping more detailed journals while I was on tour.
You just forget, don't you?
Which I think, to be honest, mate, it was one of those things. Like, I was thinking as well, like, I went to the National Army Museum recently, shout out to them. And, there was a pair of like Oakley gloves, you know, in one of their display cases. And I thought about my gloves, you know, and I thought, I've had those for three tours. And they looked all, you know, they were all just like totally stained and had the fingers cut off them. And, you know, they had oil on them. And I thought, you know, these things have touched IEDs. They've been on a gun. And at the end of the tour, I just chucked them in the burn pit. And it's just, and the other one is camera footage. I'm like, how, like, all of us, we had some pretty, like, we didn't have loads of stuff, but we had some pretty cool, you know, like contact videos and stuff at the end of the tour. And no one bothered to back them up. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure mine got wiped because I got a virus on my laptop. Not sure where that could have come from. But, you know, like, you just thinking, like, why didn't I back up those on 500 different hard drives and stick them in safes in banks across the country? So they'd just be like, I mean, I think it's just at the time, you just assume that you're just going to do another one. It's so normal to you.
Mm.
It's only like looking back on it, you're like, oh, that wasn't actually a normal experience.
Yeah.
But when you're young and you're in your 20s and it's like your second, third tour or whatever, you're like, oh, well, this is just what we do. This is normal.
It's such a big part of history. And thankfully, you know, in the advent of social media and obviously media in general, it's documented really well. And the fact that there was body cams and all the rest of it. So there is parts of it, but there's so much of this social history that will be lost.
Yeah.
And did a lot of blokes write journals when they were out?
I think it's just me, to be honest with you.
What was the reason for that then? Why did you actually start doing that?
I think there might have been something in my mind at that point that I did want to write about the tour. I think maybe after after Iraq, I'd realised my... I think I may... And this is guesswork now, but I think I probably realised my mistake after Iraq.
Mm.
And I probably, because I did, you know, I did two tours there, and I probably thought, oh God, that was silly. I should have kept, you know. I think I probably, like, even being out of Iraq for 6 months was probably long enough for me to start reminiscing about it. And it was at that point that I probably realized, and this is, like I said, guessing, but I'm just getting, you know, I think what probably happened is I was like, oh, I wish I'd documented that more. So, you know, going into Iraq, I think there was definitely a, I decided by that point, I was like, I do want to write a book. I am going to write a book about this. Because I used to read so many war memoirs and things. I think I just kind of got to that point in my life, mid-20s, where I started to have a bit more confidence that I could do things. If I said I was going to do something, I could do it, you know. And I was thinking, well, why can't I write a war memoir? And look, the other thing about Afghanistan was there wasn't much distraction, was there? If you're in a patrol base in the middle of nowhere with no electronics or anything like that, it's back to basics. And one of those things that's good to, like, I did enjoy writing blueies when I was on tour, when I was in Iraq. I enjoyed writing blueies in Afghanistan.
Letters back home.
Yeah, letters back home, yeah. So it's just kind of an extension of that, really. You know, but you can be a bit more honest than you are in a bluey.
That's interesting. I mean, I you know, just when you're talking then, there's hundreds of blueys in my loft, actually, that are just in a box.
Right.
And yeah, I've not even looked at them.
It's probably
I've not
great
looked at
information.
Them for 15 years.
I had a look through Alice when I was putting the book together to think, is there anything that I've missed in here? And there were some really, there's some really useful bits and pieces in there. Because obviously people are getting a sanitized version of things, but that in itself is an interesting one. You know, like on a day I got blown up and we had casualties and, you know, really bad day. That day I wrote a bluey home when we got to Musakala. And it's just really kind of like weird looking at it, thinking like, I know what happened before this. But I thought if my family were reading this, they wouldn't have a clue. Because I'm just talking about Call of Duty and asking them to record the NFL for me. And I'm thinking, like, they're going to have no idea, like, they don't know what happened that morning, you know, a couple of hours before I wrote that letter. But I think you could see in that letter as well, I think you could see I was suffering from a concussion because it's, like, it's all over the place, which might just be what my writing is. But it's, you know, what it's there's one paragraph, I'm about a paragraph in, and I just kind of say, like, gosh, this is taking me, like, 40 minutes to write, you know. And I don't think I realised then that we probably were suffering with, like, you know, concussions, you know, coupled with... you know, a bit of heat exhaustion and all that kind of stuff. And like, I mean, I can write a book in a month. I don't know why it took me hours to write a page of a letter.
Yeah. Who was you writing the blueies home to? Your mum?
No, that one was to my brother. I did write them home to my parents, and then I had some to friends, and then I had some to my brothers.
Yeah. Did you collate all them then? Have you read all everything you've sent
not
back?
Not everything back, not to friends, but the ones to my family I have to. The ones to the family I have to.
Yeah.
But you know, the ones the family are very kind of, you know, there's not really much useful information in there. It's like when it, in terms of like trying to put a book together, it's stuff like, oh, it's really hot out here. Yeah, everything's cool. Eating ration packs. Yeah, you know, it's that kind of stuff. You know, it's nothing like Charlie's in the Trees kind of, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But I suppose even like small snippets would be able to like evoke an emotion.
I mean, to be honest, the journal's the best for those. You know, the journal's really good for that. Like the journal, you can still see like you can see the sweat and the grime and the dust in it and all that kind of stuff. And it's the journal. Yeah, the journal's good for it. The journal does kind of take you back.
A real piece of history.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty cool. Pretty alley there. It'd be worth a lot of money one day.
Definitely, mate.
Yeah, they're really cool though, mate. Like it's one of those things that like you kind of value your possessions differently as you get a bit older and wiser or whatever. And I just think like I, you know, those are the kind of things of, you know, it's nice to have a. Well, I say that I haven't got a watch, but I'm sure it's nice to have a nice watch for a nice car and all that. But then something like that, you know, they're just irreplaceable. You know, something like that is just irreplaceable.
Yeah. Mate, yeah, I agree. The when you got, what year was that?
2009 in Afghan.
2009, so it wasn't until really 2015 when you started taking writing seriously.
Yeah, 2015 I started writing it up. It's when I was working on ships, doing ship security. Mm. All of a sudden I had like a bit of time, you know, quite a bit of time on my hands. I'd started to write, I think it was probably end of 2013, I think I started to try, I started to try and write for the first time, but I wasn't writing books, I was trying to write screenplays, because I thought, this, I'll get rich doing this. And, so I started doing the screenplays. And then it was just, what kind of happened was with the screenplays, is, it turned out that I was quite good at writing them. Because I was a novice as well, but I was decent at doing them, and I started to shop a couple around in LA, and I got some interest in one of them, and things started moving along, and I thought, wow, this is easy. I don't know what everyone's been complaining about, and I thought I'm going to be a millionaire in no time, and it was everything looked great, and I was taking meetings at these great companies, and. Then this one company were like, yeah, we want to work with you on this idea of yours. And I thought, oh, I'm going to have a TV show. This is amazing. And then one day they were just like, actually, yeah, don't want to do this anymore. And I thought, God, I've just put 6 months into this. And you don't see any money for that kind of that time, you know, because you're just developing this idea. Like, I mean, there are development projects and stuff people get. But for someone at my level, I thought this could happen every year. Someone could say yes. We could work on it a bunch, then they could say no, and I'll never see any money for it. And I thought, I don't want to do ship security forever, even if I did think the industry was going to last forever, which, you know, I didn't think it would. So I did a bit more research into it, and I thought, well, because the problem with writing screenplays is your barriers to entry, it's really hard to get in past the gatekeepers, you know, who are, you know, they don't accept unsolicited material anywhere. Mm. So if you haven't been to a film school and if you don't have people in the industry that you know, I mean, I was lucky that I made friends when I was in the States, you know, visiting there, and they helped me with some contacts. But, you know, I was starting from a position of not knowing anybody really. I was very lucky that there was like this guy, Ray, you know, shout out to him. He was, you know, he used to be a producer with Sony, and he took some time out to mentor me. And I was very, you know, I just got really lucky that I met some very good people who were, you know, willing to help me.
Look's one thing, but you had created the material. Like that, I think that we have to, interject there, because I think you're putting yourself down. If you don't create the material first.
Yeah.
Then you're not in a position where that look the you know
yeah and look here's the other come. Thing as well, mate, is I was putting all of my money into flying to America to go to LA to go to these places. Like, it wasn't coincidence that I was going into these places in LA where all my money was going into. So no, you're right, I am playing that down. Like, I was going halfway across the world to try and make it happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of work that's
yeah that was this. I didn't bump into him in Wrexham. Yeah. It was a lot of work going into it, but I just realized, you know what, like, if I write a book. If I write a book, it's going to see the light of day. I can be the person that makes it see the light of day, even if I don't get a publisher on board. There's still ways of getting it done. With a screenplay, you're looking at millions of dollars, really, even for like a lower production one. Like, there's some of these, the budgets of some of these things I was writing, the budgets would be like 50 to 100 million. that's not getting done on your own. It's not getting done with two people. It requires studios on board. You've got to get past so many different hurdles to get it done, which doesn't mean that you shouldn't try. But I thought, let's be realistic about this. You know, this is, it's because the thing is, well, I'm not American, so I can't live and work in America. I think things would be different if I probably have kept going down the screenplay route if I had, because I could have taken a job as in LA, as a lot of people done, and keep going down that track. But for me, I could only visit LA. So I thought, right, well, I need my work, my writing time to go into something that's going to give me a higher chance of success. Now, it might be like the success that comes back from it might be less financially, or it might be less glitz and glamour. But I thought, if I write a book, I'm going to back myself that it will get published. So at the very least, I'm getting a return on my work. So I thought, well, right, what can I write? And I thought, well, I've got two notebooks full of notes from Afghanistan here. I've always wanted to write a war memoir. Why don't I write a war memoir? And that's how I started, by literally just writing up the anecdotes, by expanding on the anecdotes. So going from, say, half a page in a notebook to a chapter, started doing that, started listening to, at the time, I still had lost most of my videos and stuff from Afghan, so I'd listen to the audio back, pick out the dialogue, you know, make some notes on terrain, all that. And I didn't have a structure for the book at first. I just started writing the anecdotes, and just gradually it just started to, the feel of it started to come through. And I was thinking, like, well, what else, what's nobody done in a war memoir that I've sat here? And I thought, I've never seen anybody sprinkle in throughout the book these kind of like flash forwards of what's going to happen after the tour. Because the thing about writing a war memoir, everyone knows you come through it, or you wouldn't be writing the book. And if you've lost a leg or whatever, publishers like to plaster that all over the cover. So there's no kind of surprises from there. So I thought, look, people know I survived this book, but what they might not know is what happens after the tour. So I started by placing these little snippets of flash forwards throughout the book. And then eventually, you know, over time, that expanded into, you know, basically a quite a large section at the back of the book, which is about how things went bad after the tour and then how things went better. And I thought, and I still don't think that anybody else has really done that with the kind of honesty that I have. There's been people that have mentioned PTSD and that kind of stuff because it kind of ticks a box now in the marketing strategy. But I don't think that anybody had kind of gone to the level of honesty that I had with it. And I think that's kind of what, you know, with any project, you should always be looking at, right, what makes you? Because there's thousands of soldiers out there with thousands of stories, each one of them valid for its own reasons. And I thought, well, what is it that I can bring to the table? I'm not a Victoria Cross winner. I'm not a double amputee. I'm not, you know, haven't rowed across the ocean or anything. So I thought, well, what I can do is I could just be totally honest about my experience, which, to be honest, I personally haven't come across before. Is just an absolute total honesty, and I understand why, because, you know, for a lot of people, they have an image to maintain. Especially people if they work in the corporate sector, it's not okay to say that you high fived your mate after you shot someone. That's not something that most people can say. I'm lucky that I work for myself and I'm an author. And, you know, I don't have to answer to a boss, because a lot of people's books, they come out, they're not full-time authors. You know, these are people that are working for other people. I thought, work for myself, only got to answer to myself. I'm continuing to write for the rest of my life, I think. And I thought, well, that gives me a unique position that I can, you know, I can leverage that. I can leverage total honesty, can be my selling point.
I mean, it gives authenticity as well, and you're very authentic about what you put out there. You don't hold back a lot of the time, especially on things like your podcast as well. Like, you are you almost, like, you know, at the core, kind of cold face in the book, but on the cold face of being true to yourself as well, and true to that, the community of what you're part of. The just take it back to the kind of planning phase of the book. You just said it was just words. You just started writing.
This one was, mate. Yeah, I mean, I've written. I think I'm going on 10 books, and I have 9 or 10 books that I've written now. You know, I think 7 published now. I've got 7 or 8 published, and then there's another one coming out in October, and then I've got another 2 that I've already written, which I'm going to publish over the next 9 months. fiction, non-fiction, it's a mix.
Oh, okay. But this one is very personal to you, this memoir.
This
you
know, one is here.
Brothers in Arms is,
but this is
your memoir.
As far as planning goes, this one is the anomaly. Because this one literally just came from how I felt on the day. Like, so, you know, there's chapters in there that I wrote years ago, and there's chapters that I wrote just before going to publishing. Mm. That was kind of all over the place. You know, it's not the way that I usually write. The way that I usually write is very regimented.
Mm. How would you do that now? How would you plan that now?
This Afghan book, mate, is it wasn't planned, and I don't think I'd want to plan it. Mm. So it's reflective of the different stages of my life. Like there was some of this book was written where the only thing I was planning on was where to get drugs from. So I wasn't planning books, you know, I'm planning, right, where am I going to get money to get off my face? Mm. So there definitely wasn't any grand strategizing or anything like that now. All the other books I've done have been very different. They've been very like kind of like strategically planned and tactically executed. This was like, I don't have kids. This is as close as I think I have to a kid, where it wasn't planned. And I kind of felt my way through with things as it happened. I was, you know, kind of getting to grips with it. But it's not how I would recommend going about. It's not how I would recommend going about doing a book, to be honest. Mm. But the other thing as well with it, mate, was market forces at the time. Is when I first took this to publishers, they were like, "Yeah, we love it, but there's not a market for military books right now." So that meant that it sat in the project cupboard for a couple of years. As a result, I think that benefited it, because I got to add some chapters of me coming out the other end rather than it just finishing in the dark place.
Mm.
So I think it benefited from that. But it would have been a different book if the market forces had been good 2 years ago. Right now we'd just come. I think we're coming to an end, to be honest, now of a wave of books like, you know, Brian Woods being there. You know, obviously your Aunt Middleton's, you know, there's been a lot of military books in the last couple of years. And I think we're going to start to see that drawing down a bit now.
Mm.
You know, like, it's like anything in business, you know, and the arts, you know, things come in waves, things become fashionable.
The one thing about you, though, is you write for other people as well.
Yep.
And you also, you're making a business out of this.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a one-off.
Yeah.
You know, it's again and again and again. The writing process then, come away from the memoir for a second. So, the writing process, you talk about like discipline and regimented mm-hmm. and whatnot. What would it take then for, if someone's listening, what would be the planning and then the writing of producing something?
Well, one of the things I think people fall down, there's two big problems that I see with people with it when it comes to books. The first one is people will ask me and ask other people, how do I get published? And my question is always, have you written the book? To which the answer is usually no. So people worry about publishing before they worry about writing. And that's like a big mistake. Now, I'm a big believer in visualization. And if you want to picture your book at number one on the charts, and then I'm all for that. But if you're doing that, then you have to. So if you're thinking about your book being number one in the charts, then you're acknowledging that you want your book to be a commercial success. Well, if you want your book to be a commercial success, then you need to approach it as a professional. And a professional doesn't go asking people about getting, you know, how to get published when they haven't even written a book. I mean, that's like saying, how do I, you know, how am I going to lift the World Cup in the Rugby World Cup, and I haven't started passing a ball around? I mean, it's pretty ridiculous, to be honest. And when you say that, you just make yourself look stupid. I'm just being honest. If you ask that to someone, you've already, like, you only get one first impression with people. And if someone asks me that, I'm still going to try and help that person, but I've shifted them into the amateur category rather than this is somebody who's got, because sometimes people approach me, this guy, I'm not going to name him on here recently, me and him have been having some good chats, people know him on Instagram and stuff, me and him have been chatting, and I think he can genuinely write a great book that will be successful commercially. But I knew straight away, right, this is a guy who's got what it takes to be a commercial success. Whereas if someone's just like, how do I get a book published? Have you written the book? No. Then that's, you know, that's a warning. The other thing is people, people, I, for some reason, think that you can just jump into doing a book and figure it out as you go along, which, you know, it's nuts for any business. Like, you wouldn't, if you wanted to, say, have a retail store selling clothes, you don't just open a, or well, you shouldn't, just open a shop that hasn't got any stock in, or any, you know, you haven't built up any awareness that this shop is coming or anything. You just open up a shop and occasionally you chuck a couple of t-shirts in there on a rack. I mean, that business is going to fail. Writing a book is no different. You can't just have this thing of, you don't know where the books are. Let's talk fiction here, because I think this is probably the common one. People just start writing and they think that the book is going to figure itself out as it goes along. I mean, that is an absolute recipe for disaster. The problem is you'll get occasionally some big author, like let's say a Lee Child, will say, oh, I don't have a plan. I just start writing and I figure it out as I go along. Well, here's the difference. Lee Child has been writing for probably over 30 years. So even though he might not have a plan in paper, he's done it so many times that he has a plan in his head. And, you know, without knocking his books, because I enjoy him, his books are very formulaic, right? So as are most books, as are my books, his books are formulaic. So once you've done it a bunch of times, you don't need necessarily the same detailing on paper. But the other thing that the other advantage he gets is that he gets paid a lot of money as an advance for each book. And he only needs to write one book a year, and it's his full-time job. So if things don't go well for him, he has the time and the money to throw that idea in the bin and go back and start from the beginning. Like, he can do that process if it's enjoyable for him, because he has the, you know, he's in a position to be able to do so. Most people not in that position. So most people trying to get into writing are going to be writing around their job and around their family. You know, it's not going to be, you're not going to come in and get paid. And here's the other thing as well, I'll just throw this in there. If you're expecting to get a massive advance for writing books, it's probably not going to happen. It's definitely not going to happen straight off the bat for 99.9% of people, right? You have to look at this as this is essentially a hobby that you hope you're going to get paid for. So it's something that you're going to be working around your family.
Or not. Mm. Some people write for other reasons as well, therapeutic reasons or business reasons. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of different
reasons. So I'll come on to those. But if you're writing because you want to get published... So if you're writing, you want to get published commercially, this applies to you. Like, if you're writing therapeutic, my advice would be, there is no right or wrong way of doing it. Just do whatever makes you feel happy. But if you're writing with the aim of getting published and you want a publisher and you're going to take this into the business side of things, then you need to be smart with your time and you need to plan, right? So I think one problem people have is if you don't go into a book, you should know going into the book, what is your book about? And now that sounds so obvious, but a lot of people, that they might have just an idea of a character. But what is the book about? What are you trying to tell people? What is the message you're going to try and get across? What is the story you're taking, you know, people on? So if you are starting with, let's say you've got this idea of a really interesting character. Well, that's great, but we don't just want to follow a character around. The character needs to be on a mission. You know, is the character's mission to get something back? Is the character's mission to find something? Is the character's mission to stop something happening? You know, there needs to be a clearly defined mission. Just like, you don't just go, right, we're going to go on patrol and we're going to aimlessly wander around. You know, it's right, we're going to go on patrol because we're going to go to the mosque.
So the objective is there.
Exactly. There needs to be an objective. Then what you need to do, so like, figure that out. In one sentence, figure out what your book is about. You should be able to still distill that book about. So this is a book about a man who has a podcast that saves the world, right? So you start as simple as that and then expand it to a paragraph. So this is a podcast about a man who saves the world with his podcast, and on the way he has to do such and such and such and such, and that happens, and this happens, and in the end this happens. And you keep expanding. So you keep expanding and then expand to a page, and you should be able to condense your whole story into the page. So who are the main characters going to be? All the main twists and turns. So a lot of people struggle because they'll get halfway through the book and then realize, oh God, this doesn't make sense, because there's something that, you know, something just doesn't add up, or some person was in the, it's impossible for these people to be in the right place, the same place at the same time, or a glaring plot hole that if you'd have just worked out at the beginning. Mm. You could have worked it out at that stage.
Does that go then, because we said fiction there, but does that go for non-fiction as well?
I think for non-fiction, it works.
To have that pitch, yeah. Basically, you're pitching to yourself,
yeah.
Or you're giving it to you or me or whoever else and said, do you understand that book?
Yes.
In one page, like 1,000 words, covering the full book.
Absolutely. And then you should go a step further, which is then break down chapter by chapter, everything that happens in each chapter. So chapter one, Gez goes into a shop and sees his book and has a heart attack because somebody's drawn a moustache on him, right? That be chapter one, right? And it could be a sentence like that. And you could go through with each chapter. And then what you've done then is you've making sure that your story runs smoothly, that like all your twists make sense, your turns make sense. If it's a non-fiction book, what you're looking for in non-fiction is, like, let's say in non-fiction your book is you know, you're writing something about let's say Roman history, that you're doing the complete Roman history. Well, you might notice if you do a chapter by chapter breakdown, oh god, I've missed out 100 years here, you know, so you're looking at it to give yourself the chance right now to make sure that all your bases are covered, everything makes sense, all the twists, turns, all of that stuff, it all stacks up. And if it doesn't, now's your chance to work on it. And then you can start adding a bit of clay to this. Mm. So if you think, oh, that'd be a really great thing for him to say here, or oh, your car chase would be really good here, you know what? I think this is where he needs to, you know, he probably needs to meet a new character here, you know, to spice the story up. He has a love interest.
Are you physically writing that out then?
And like, fleshing it out.
Does it need to make sense at that point?
Yeah, everything needs. Like,
no. What I mean is, like, are you looking at grammar? Are you looking at kind of spelling?
I don't bother about that even as I write the book.
Yeah,
mate, I'm not even bothered about that.
That's what I mean. At this point in the writing process, it's just about getting.
I think what people misconstrue is writing a book is telling a story. It's not being grammatical. Okay, so fiction, right? Fiction is telling a story and entertaining people, right? Your grammar doesn't need to be perfect. What needs to be close to perfect is your ability to sell a story. You'll get help later on from editors and
that's what I'm getting at. So yeah. That process at this stage, it's just
don't worry about that. Your job as a fiction writer is to entertain people and tell a story. Mm. Same with fiction. You know, with fiction, if I said to you right now a fact about the Second World War, and as I said it, I said Winston Churchill instead of Churchill, would that stop that fact sinking in with you?
Well, yeah, I'll just figure out. I would remember that bit.
Yeah, okay, but what I mean is, it's like, so you'd still know what I was talking about.
Sorry, Emma.
Yeah, you'd know what I was talking about. You wouldn't go, who was Winston? Winston Churchill? Never heard of him. You'd go, oh, he's on about Winston Churchill. So same thing as you're plotting out your nonfiction. As long as it makes sense to you at that point, it doesn't matter.
And also, it is about you, isn't it, at this point? Because no one else is reading it at this stage. And
no one's seen it. Like,
so I produced a book very much about our business, totally different to yours. And it was good to hear what you just said then. So what I did originally was come up with, funnily enough, I came up with a title, the subtitle, and what it was all about. Mm-hmm. So what you said, like the initial pitch, like, all right, so that makes sense to me. That makes sense to me, ma'am. That makes sense to me, mate. Like, people understand it. Then I wrote 1,000 words going from the start to the finish. And that changed, and we adapted it over time. Like you said, we tweaked it and we made it a little bit clearer. And then I got 50 crib cards and we wrote every chapter on a crib card, and then we had a stack then. And then we started adding all the information from there. That was our planning.
Your outlining. And like I said, this is very different to if you're just writing for therapy, write whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want, right? Because that's a totally different, but that's the difference. But the difference between writing for therapy and the difference between writing to get published, it's like the difference between kicking a ball around with your mates for a laugh and, you know, drilling every day on your drills because you want to make a professional team. Mm. You know, it's the same thing. You're kicking a football around, but the aim is very different, and therefore the execution
would you,
has to be
even
different.
If you just a question to yourself now, if you wasn't getting published, mm-hmm. or the aim wasn't to get published as such, because you can still print and publish, self-publish, would you still write in that kind of regimented
if you're
way
getting,
to get
if you want to get
there,
self-published,
high quality.
Yeah, if you want to get self-published and you want to be successfully self-published, then you need to approach it as if you were going to a publisher's, because those are the people, like, your people, that's the standard they expect. So if, you know, we talked before we came on camera, like or on the mic, sorry. If someone gives you a self-published book and the image on the cover is low resolution and it's rubbish and the book looks cheaply printed and, you know, you open it up and you can see that it's not being properly typeset, it just says amateur. And it depends, again, what your aim is. Like, if your aim is, you know, you just want to write a book that you can give to your kids, then that doesn't really matter. But if you want to sell copies of a book, you have to meet the industry standard, or it, to be honest, exceed the industry standard, because you're not going to have the marketing of the a publishing house behind you. So you have to be even better than your competition, and it's totally possible to do that. But you have to, like, I don't know what it is. It's a weird thing about writing that people think that they can just pick it up and do it without putting in the reps. You know, it's the same as anything else. You have to do your repetitions. You know, like I come back to the thing of people thinking about the deal before they've got the book. I mean, where else would people have the arrogance really to think, oh, I can just do this and it'll get published? Like, you know, I really recommend to people that, as well as this outlining stage could take months and months and months to do, to get it done. But you know what? If you get it done properly, when you then come to write it, you'll get the book written so much faster because you've already got
this
great outline.
You're planning.
Exactly.
It's the planning phase. And just to think, moves on to writing then, and we talk about the reps. So you want to lift heavier weights. There's a structure to it. You plan your training program. You then start implementing the plan and you might tweak it and change it. But you have to get the reps in. The writing process itself, so the advice you'd give on to actually physically write, Are you doing writing at the same time every day, like in the same place with the same pen or the same laptop? Like, what is kind of your best practice to writing?
I think
just getting information, just getting it
there's
down.
There's best practice for it's probably going to be different for everyone. For me, it differs a little bit. But what I found is I like to smash a book in a short period of time. So I'll have my outline good to go, and then I'll look at the calendar. I think, right, this 30-day period looks like it's going to be quite quiet. This is now my dedicated period to write this book. During that period, I'm not going to go out. I'm not going to have much of a social life or anything like that, but I'm going to get up at a reasonable time in the morning, say 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going to come downstairs, and I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to write for the first few hours of the day. And in those first few hours, I'll have hit my word count for the day. So I'll average, say, 1,000 words an hour. So in the first 3 hours of the day, I've done 3,000 words. Now I can walk away then for the rest of the day. I don't have to do anymore. I can go and do whatever I want for the rest of the day then. It's done. I'll feel good about it. I'm not editing at that point. I'm just written it. It's done. I'm leaving it as it is. I'm not going back over it or anything. And this is how I did my last book. Like, other books I've done differently, but this is the one I'm finding works best for me now. Now, if I'm really feeling it that day and I'm really enjoying writing, so it's not a case of I can do more now. Obviously, I can do more. My hands haven't fallen off. My house hasn't collapsed on top of me. I can keep writing. But if I'm not feeling it, then I'll go to the gym. I'll go for a walk, go on the mountain. I'll go see family. I'll watch TV for a day. You know, I'll just do whatever. But by sitting down first thing in the morning, oh, and here's the main thing. Before I go to bed, phone's on airplane mode and do not disturb, does not come back on until those words get done. Because as soon as that happens, that's when all the distractions come in. What I found is if I literally go from my bed to the pisser, to the chair and start writing, I do intermittent fasting as well, so I don't have to worry about breakfast in the morning. So there's not that. I'm just literally just sitting down with...
You're basically cutting out a lot of the distraction.
Cutting out all distraction, because as soon as you start that distraction, for me, the other thing as well is personally I find, I know this might be different for other people, but I find I'm very creative in the morning. First thing in the morning, you know, I usually wake up, I've got different music, I've got music in my head, I've got ideas in my head. Now, if there's a morning where, say for instance, I wake up and I can see the sun coming up and it's beautiful outside, I might say, oh, well, I'll go for a walk, but the same rules have to apply. No going on your phone. Like, you know, I can go for a walk, but not
allow myself to, I can get distracted by a sunrise, but the sunrise is only going to last for so long and it's not going to be asking me to text it and phone it and all that kind of stuff.
It's actually quite a growth promoting and nourishing
kind
of thing
feels,
to do.
It feels
as well.
Amazing. And to be honest, what I find if I do like that short 30-minute walk is I'm thinking about the writing for the day. So when I do sit down, then bump, I'm into it. So I kind of give myself a little leeway on that one. But the ones that you can't give yourself leeway on, phone has to be off, and having your word count. It doesn't have to be 3,000 words. It could be 500 words, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But doing that and then knowing then, right, that's it for the day. I've won the day. You know, you've won the day by 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, and then walk away from it. But I've done days before. I've done 8,000 words in a day before because I've just been really feeling it. And I haven't wanted to stop.
Mm.
There's been other days where it's been really hard to get that 2,000. Because what I usually set as my limit is 2,000. Because I used to do 3, but then I find that that extra 1,000 sometimes it was be. Because we all have good and bad days. If I'm writing a book over 30 days, like there's going to be distractions in those days. I might be distracted by, I might have had something happen the day before with money that distracted me, or with a relationship, you know. That. So there's going to be some mornings where it's going to be harder to do, but 2,000 I feel is attainable for me.
I know lots of people have wrote books for their businesses, and some people have got busy businesses, like maybe 1, 2, 3 different things, you know, kind of enterprises going on, a busy family life, and all they do is they almost do it like a blog. They treat it like a blog and they write the next 250 words. That built over again and again and again and again and again. And what I'm getting from you, mate, that's what I'm taking from you, is the fact that you've just got to get disciplined and regimented. If you want to create something at the end, you've got to put the reps in.
Mate, think about this, all right? If you're writing a book and you don't really know where the book is going, and you've got, let's say you've managed to carve out an hour in your morning, you've managed to carve out for writing. Let's say you don't know where your book is going, you know, because you haven't outlined. You're going to sit down and most of that hour is going to be wondering like, oh, well, what does happen next and stuff. If you sit down, you've got your outline. It's right. This is where I got to yesterday. This is the next part. I've already outlined it. I know what's happening. Now I just have to write. So there's no wasted time. There's no sitting there chewing your pen. It's already laid out there and you're just coming in. It's like you've got the skeleton and you're coming in. Right. What do I need to cover up today? Okay. The arm. And you just start putting the flesh on the arm. Right. Whereas if you don't have that plan, people are going to sit there. And once you start thinking, oh, now I've only got 30 minutes left, now I've only got 15 minutes left, of course nothing's going to get done. Mm. So that's why the outline is so important.
Having the plan. So like for me, the 30 to 50 crib cards ended up being, like if I want, and a man is very much, it's very different to your kind of stuff. But if I want feeling like that particular subject, I would move on to another one and I'd write 1,000 words on that. There was no like...
I think that can work for non-fiction. I don't recommend it with fiction. It depends how, to be honest, it depends on experience. Like I'm at a position in fiction now where I can do that. Like I can go off and go, let's say I did go for a walk in the morning and I had an idea for, you know, because I already know what the scenes are going to be, but I had some dialogue come into my head. I think because, one, it's my full-time job and, you know, I've written a lot of projects by now, I can write that one that's down the line and go back to the others. I do not recommend that for people that are starting out in fiction. Non-fiction, 100%. Non-fiction, you can jump around a lot more. Mm. Non-fiction is a bit more of a jigsaw, whereas you're going to make each of your pieces and then it's all going to fit together quite straightforward. You know, like every story is in its way a jigsaw. But with fiction, you've got very clearly defined chapters, right? Mm. And that can piece together. You know, like non-fiction doesn't have to be as linear.
Because like, you know, like your book, Brothers in Arms, that almost sounded chaotic the way you was writing that.
Yeah, it was. Backwards, I mean, forward, it was a chaotic part of my life, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was reflected in the writing.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, everything about my life right then was chaotic.
Yeah.
You know, and like, this stuff is supposed to be fun and it's supposed to be, you know, this right, you know, I don't believe in writer's block. I think a lot of people stress themselves out about this, and I'm trying to, by having these kind of routines and practices, find the least stressful way of, you know, it shouldn't be something that, I hate seeing memes and stuff by writers about how hard it is and how horrible it is, and it's like, hey, don't get me wrong,
if you're writing about a tragic part of your life, it will get emotionally, it will be emotionally tough, but it will also be emotionally rewarding. But writing fiction or a non-fiction book about business should be fun.
Mm.
It should be fun. If it's like, and you've got to look at, you know, it, how to, like, it's like going to the gym. If people don't make time in their day for when they're going to go to the gym, then they start to get stressed because, oh, God, I'm not going to get down to the gym today. I can't believe me blooming kids wouldn't, you know, couldn't get out. And it starts, something that's supposed to be a release for you starts to become the stress inducer rather than the stress release. So I got a new word for this stuff, actually. It's called anti-demons is my new thing. A lot of people have antioxidants. So I got anti-demons now. So one anti-demon would be the gym, but another would be writing. So if one of your little anti-demons is causing you more stress than it's releasing, then you need to go back and have a look at how to do it. And I just think that, you know, planning in anything is just so important and overlooked. And, you know, same as, I think the gym is a great, like, kind of analogy for it. It's, yeah, you can go in and you can just kind of like faff around or whatever and have no plan. But if you have a plan and you know, right, I'm going to go in the gym today. This is exactly what I'm going to do. Bum, bum, bum. I'm going to do this as a warm-up. I'm going to get on the bench. I'm going to do this. This is the weight I'm going to do. Those are the best sessions you have. And it's the same with writing. Like, if you know what you're going to do going into it and you've got it planned, you know, you have a great session. And I believe momentum is so important in life. So if you build the daily practice of, like, let's say you've done 10 days in a row, you've done your 500 words like you said you were going to do, you can see you're working your way through the outline. Mm. So there's a real measure of progress there. And then you're building up your momentum. You know, it's going to get, you're going to want to keep going and keep going. If, on the other hand, your momentum has been 3 mornings you didn't get up out of bed to start writing, another day you got up but started, like, messing around on your phone and then you realised your writing time was over, another day, because you haven't outlined, you just stared at the screen. Like, what kind of momentum is that building? It's just a negative kind, and that's why people keep giving up.
It's good, mate, and I think that we've covered a lot there, and we've covered a lot on planning. And I think, like anything, that planning phase needs to be thorough. It needs to have direction, and it needs to be really clear and simple to implement as well. Because the more complex something is, the less likely you're going to do it. Like, the more barriers you put in place, the more phone apps you've got open and you're doing it, mm-hmm. the more excuses. And it doesn't have to be. I'm giving permission to people now. To, like, if you have got busy lives, it doesn't have to be in the morning, it can be in the evening, you just got to, like you said, you keep momentum. It's really excellent advice. Going up from, we finished the first draft, do you then review it and go for a second draft?
Yeah, so I just got to say one thing as well, I forgot to answer on earlier, you know, talking about favourite pens and all that kind of stuff. That is, to me as well, is just another way of finding excuses to then not do the work for the day.
Mm.
So it's like, if that is going to bother you, get rid of all the pens in your house and just buy one kind or whatever. But don't worry about, oh, I've got to write on it. I use Google Docs to do my writing. Like, you don't need anything fancy. You don't need a certain kind of notepad or this pen. Just, you know, bloody do it. As far as second drafts go, so basically what I do is, mate, and again, this comes down to planning. Again, everything goes back to planning, mate. And the reason why is because I usually have very little work to do on my second draft, because it's everything got worked out in the planning.
Mm.
So I'm not going to go, I'm not going to sit down and go, all right, time to read it back now. There's going to be no, oh, that doesn't add up, because it was all sorted out in the planning. All I'm doing when I read back through it is I'm going, oh, well, that sentence could make more sense if I wrote it this way, or that could have been a better way of saying it, or, you know, I think personally I overwrite a bit, so it's trimming back on a bit of a writing.
Do you do that?
I do that myself first. Basically, mate, when I submit my manuscript to a publisher, I almost want the editor to be redundant. I don't like, so what people need to understand, there's a difference between an editor who gives you the kind of the creative advice and input. So, you know, they might say, well, I'd like to see more of this character, or I'd like to see less of this, or I'd like the tension to be ratcheted up here. And then there's an editor who, the copy editors, they're the ones who go through picking out mistakes and all that kind of stuff. Mm. So you need to understand.
There's a copywriter and then there's the editor who's helping you produce it.
Exactly. You need to understand there's a difference between the two. And what I want from my editors, who are let's call them the creative editors, I want as little feedback as possible from them when I've written the book. And that's because I want to have done a really good job of the book. Now, where I want, and I will show my outlines to editors, because that to me is the time to get the where to get really other people's opinions on the story, is at the outline stage. But you know, when it comes to, you know, missing spelling mistakes and all that, I don't really give a crap about that. Like, I want to clean that up because I want to minimize their work, but I'm not getting hung up on that.
Yeah.
You know, what I'm getting hung up on is the story, the characters, the pace, you know, the tension, all that kind of stuff.
With the memoir, obviously, again, totally different, and I think a lot of the listeners will be at this stage now, you know, the planning and the writing's quite similar, but then at this stage where we're looking at second draft, edit, copywriting, what did you do? Did you go to a creative to go through the memoir?
No, I mean, again, it was, I had a very clean manuscript, you know, in like, I was very happy with what was there. Now, we have made changes to the manuscript since it went to a publisher's, but, you know, when I take something to a publisher, I want it to be, you know, I want it to be very shelf ready. You know, I don't want to take a project to them. I want to take a almost finished product, right? And it's there then helping me to polish the product rather than to shape the product.
Mm.
So the chapters, you know, we took a few things out here and there. We had some legal issues, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the structure didn't change. You know, the tone of the book didn't change. Yeah, None of that stuff. All of that stuff stayed as it was.
Was the voice yours, or did you know?
When, the voice is 100% mine. Yeah.
Yeah. So the when the copywriter got involved, did a copywriter get involved?
All the copy editor did was things like if I'd used the wrong, if I'd put a comma in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Or if that's all.
It's really vital though. I mean, like for mine, my so obviously mine is self-published. Mm-hmm. Right, it's business, and I hope this will resonate because one is obviously yours is the professional side of things, mm-hmm. going through that the publisher. Mine is not. But I found a copywriter who then helped me edit. Thank you, Shirley. And she was brilliant, and she, because we know each other, she knew my tone of voice. So yeah.
I see what you mean. No, mine already had that. What they were doing is sometimes. Basically, I'll, you know, sometimes when you're writing, you might write the same word twice by accident. So you might go, Geraint, because it's like you might have stopped to think for a second and then started and put the extra word in. It was a cleanup rather than I get what you're getting at, but it was literally like they're cleaning up where I've made typos.
Yeah.
They're cleaning up typos.
So for me, that full process, and again, mine was about 35,000 words, right? Created a decent sized book. Yours is a lot more. But mine at that point, that cost me about like 1,500 quid or a grand or something like that to get someone in. I'm just giving the advice now, like putting it down to bit. That's what that converted with. Yeah. So someone who really went through it, was passionate about that project and the edit and the copywriting. That's roughly how much that was to get the self-published side of things.
It's like when I ghostwrite for people, mate. I'm not ghostwriting in my voice. I'm ghostwriting in their voice.
Mm.
You know, and that's what you said. That's where that comes in there. I mean, that's why you pay money for a decent ghostwriter, is because, you know, you should be hearing their voice on the page, not the ghostwriter's voice.
Like their accent and everything. You know, like you hear that, don't you?
And the more time you get to spend with that person, the better. Like that's one thing I do find when I ghostwrite, is I have to go back and do quite a bit of editing on the earlier chapters because I didn't know the person as well. So by the time I get to the later chapters, I've spent a lot of time with that person. But like the earlier chapters, you're kind of guessing sometimes about how they'd say things because you haven't spent that much time.
Oh, okay.
And by the time you get to the end of the process, you've spent more time together, and then it's just a case of going back, rewriting the first bits a bit, you know, because you've got to know them.
With regards ghostwriting in its kind of basic form, because I know an organisation, I don't know how good they are, and I'm not going to endorse them, but they charge about 15 grand for 24 hours of someone's time over the telephone to ghostwrite a book.
Wow.
So. And I don't know if that's good or bad. I don't know what the scheme of that is, but it's that there is options for people to do that out there. Do you know, like, it's not, if you want to produce something and you don't want to write it, there is other ways of doing that. There's also things like like an app called Rev.com, which that is a very good way of producing something, and that's like audio, so you speak into it, it sends it off, and someone
transcribes it
back for you. It's a really good way, and it helped me do mine where I was just in a flow, and I was a bit bored of writing, so like the times where you've done 2,000, you're like, I could do with some more here, but I'm going to flick it on now. And then you get a Word document an hour later. And it's
That's really cool. I didn't know about that.
It's a nice little, what do they call it? Like a little hack.
Yeah.
Rev.com. It's about $1 a minute, though. So there is a cost to that, but it does produce something really good.
That's interesting.
Especially if you go for a walk and you want to keep it going. And what you can do is you can write, go for a walk. As
and
you're walking,
just copy and paste
write it. So you're still speaking. And then you come back in. By the time you've got back in, had a shower or whatnot, then there'll be a document in your inbox saying there'll be a document in your inbox with another 500 or 1,000 words in that you never had before. Going from edit, print, and then publish, what is the professional process of that? So once you've got the book done, artwork done, everything kind of in order, where do you go from there?
Well, you know, for me, it's like my publishers took care of my artwork and stuff. Like, so, and again, it's everyone is different. There's no such thing as an exact. It does, the different things happen at different times. So, you know, with this book, there was a couple of different publishers that were interested in it. My agent took it to a couple of different publishers. You know, we had a few publishers put our initial offers in. Then they bid against, you know, they bid against each other. And then, you know, you take your... You know, you get them to their highest bids, and then you look at the money, and you look at which editors you'd be working with. You know, I had a choice of good editors in a couple of different places, I had previous relationships in different ones, and then the money comes into it, and then you just make a decision on which one I wanted to go with. You know, so I was very fortunate from that point of view. And then they helped, you know, they did the cover, which I was really happy with. They did an amazing cover. The editors helped me slim some parts of the book down, because when you're writing something personal, it could be quite hard to chop things down. Mm. So they were really helpful there.
How many words are in that?
It was at one point it was 120,000. Yeah. And then I think we printed on about 104.
Okay.
But there was parts in it where, you know, because a book like this, there's legal stuff. So the lawyers went through it. So me and the lawyers had to, you know, me and the lawyers had a lot of back and forth where I threw my teddy out the pram a few times, you know, because I wasn't happy with what they wanted me to change. And there was a lot of that.
Is that worth doing then for someone who's listening now, who's thinking about doing a memoir? Is that something?
Oh, you might get sued. If you say something about someone, you could expect to get sued.
Okay, so advice then would be what? So to get that.
I mean, you should get if you're writing a non-fiction book which involves, especially if you're writing a book, let's say you're in the fire service, or you're a copper, or you're in the services, or even if you just worked with other people, if you, for instance, so for one of the things we had to get taken in is I can't say who it was, I had the opinion of somebody that they were a coward, and I'd put in the book, and I hadn't even used their name, I just used their position, and I'd said that I thought they were a coward, and I wasn't allowed to put that in because I can't prove that they were a coward.
Who would you go to then to help you with that?
I mean, I don't know, mate. The in-house lawyers did it with me, but I guess you'd have to go to an entertainment attorney.
Yeah, okay. So someone who's specialised in publishing.
Specialising in publishing law, you know, because I suppose it's libel, isn't it? And you know, because they were basically trying to head off potential lawsuits. Because, like, don't get fooled into thinking that there's a freedom of speech thing where you can say whatever you want in a book. Just say it's your opinion. That's not actually true. You can't. You can't. You still need to buy. Like, if you're going to say your opinion of someone is, let's say you thought, I worked with this bloke. I always thought he was a bit dodgy. He's probably a criminal. Well, you better have some facts to back that up. Because if you're just saying that, then that person can come and probably going to be successful in suing you. In which case, your book's going to get pulled from wherever it's published. You're going to owe that person a lot of money, and you might not. You know, you're probably going to have to rewrite the book.
That's sound advice with me with regards to getting it to that stage. I think we was at, before the books arrived, we were at about $2,500. I think we'd spent on artwork, getting it to a point where we were really happy with it, and then sending it off to the print. What was it like getting the book? Did you get a box or did you get
for the
like
first
a...
time? You know what, mate? Like, I'm. It's always like an anticlimactic moment for me, to be honest. I'm quite a competitive person and I'm already thinking about the next project. By the time I've got the deal and the book's done,
yeah.
Don't get me wrong, it's still kind of it is cool, but I'm already thinking like, right, well, what's the next? Like, and I try and be more present and more grateful of those moments.
Yeah.
But by the time I got, I'd already had, I think, 6 books published by before this one. So I've had that moment, and I, you know, I try and get 3 books done a year. So without putting, trying to sound too arrogant about it, it's quite a common thing now.
Was you not bored with it? But was you at the kind of shame? Because when we got ours, it come through the port, like a big crate arrived,
yeah.
And then I got it out, and I was like, oh, that's cool. But I've already kind of like I've already moved on from this.
Yeah,
but it was a nice feeling.
Yeah, it's a nice feeling, mate. But I put it like this, right? It's like, you know. I was talking about this with a mutual mate of ours yesterday. Like, you forget some of the times that you've been shot at, when you've been shot at enough times, because anything in life can become normal to you. So if it can become normal to get shot at, it can become normal to get a book through the post that you've done. And it's like, by the time you take into account, say, foreign translations of your books, like I get sent copies of those, like what is always cool is I actually, more so than getting it sent through the post, it's seeing it in a shop for the first time.
That's
cool. And the reason I like that is because when I didn't have books published, I used to walk, if I walk past a bookshop, I'd walk in and I'd visualize seeing my book on the shelf there. So that to me is more of the moment. The other thing as well, mate, is you get a book through the post and I'm on my own in the house. What does that moment mean when you're on your own? Like, the best moments are the ones that you share with other people. So it's much more of a moment for me would be going to the supermarket with a family member and seeing the book in the supermarket. That is a lot. Like, and it might be 6 months after it's been published.
Yeah, or someone seeing it and getting in touch with you. Yeah.
That's what I love, mate. That's what I love. If I hear it off a family, me taking it out of a box is cool, but getting it, if I've got, like one of my mates recently is in Bali and someone's reading the book in Bali.
Yeah, that is cool. Yeah.
That's so much cooler. Yeah. Like, do you know what I mean? Because it's like,
we got ours, and I got a book, and I'm part of like a business community as well. And there's a thing when everyone gets a book published, they open the box, and it's the first time they see it. It's there. I had a big kind of cookery knife and hammed it up, you know, open it, and it was good. And that, but then there's you know, you share it, especially if you've got mentors, like business mentors, if you're going on like the kind of the road I took. But altogether, we like, I know it's different for you, but for me, because people will definitely be interested in this, I got a, you know, hardback book. What would you say the standard of that?
Love it. Yeah. Brilliant.
And $5,000, Not Your Time, from start, good artwork, a real kind of brand that we've gone through it. 500 copies in your hand was about $5,000. The benefits of a book, like, we're wrapping up now. But the benefits for you as a book, do you see that as the cash cow? Do you see the book as the cash cow?
No, not at all, mate. Like, I don't know. This isn't me having a go at anyone. So I don't think I don't want people to think I'm moaning. This is realistic. Like, I love it.
I'll tell you what. So listen, what's happening with you? Like, because we know what happened with people think the book is the thing.
Yeah, like I say about the book. So the thing about the book, right, is. There's a lot of people out there who talk about saying that they love supporting veterans and they were interested in PTSD and all that kind of stuff. And I wrote a book about that and I put it out there, and some people are interested in it. The majority of people are not. And that's fine, because the market is the market. And the market says that the most popular kind of books are not books about soldiers with PTSD. That's fine. That's what the market is. But that's why I say that's not the cash cow. It's never going to be the cash cow. What this book is for me is its legacy. Like, this book, I'm hoping, will still be getting bought long after I'm dead by people who are a squaddie in 100 years' time. There's going to be a squaddie who, like, just like I read about the First World War when I was interested in being a squaddie. I'm hoping that there's going to be squaddies in 100 years' time that read this book. So it's not the cash cow at all. It's more, this is something that I get to leave behind, you know. And it gets to tell the story about the lads that I was, you know, that I served with. So that to me is that is the important part of the book. Now, it's made me money. Yes, it's got a lot, you know, it's one of the books that allows me to be a full-time author. But it's not like,
it's, I don't see this as being, what brings me more money is writing fiction. You know, people, I think the, if you look at, there are nonfiction books out there that make a lot of money, but realistically as a career author, it's like, if you want to be a Lee Child or someone like that, then you got to make up stories and have a successful series with a recurring fictional character. So like for me, in terms of writing now, I think publishers would like it if I just made up like a character, like a Jack Reacher, and wrote that kind of series, recurring series. My brain doesn't work like that. I can't just have one thing of one type of thing going on. So I have historical fiction going, I have crime fiction. I'm about to start self-publishing some stuff as well, because I want to try that out. I like to be in charge of stuff, so I'm going to start self-publishing as well as working with the traditional ones. I'm going to do a book about Iraq. I've got just found a TV producer for a comedy that I've written for TV, so we're going to start getting that rolling. I've got a movie in pre-production over into the States that we're hoping to shoot this year. So loads of different things, because that's what works for me. Like, I need loads of different projects with different things.
I think the thing
on.
Is, if you look at yourself as a business, which you are, you are a business. I run a business. My book is certainly about kind of leaving it on someone's desk. They're going to read it again and again. It doesn't get put in a bin like a brochure would do. You know, your memoir is going to get put on someone's desk. Like, read about this guy. This is who he's, what he's all about. This is his thoughts. That leads on to something else. And you look at the opportunity that's come from, like, Woody having his book out there. If it was never done, he wouldn't have the opportunity now. Jordan Wiley, the same. Like, his book is his business card, and he leaves it with people.
Yep.
For me, I don't have any expectations of making money from it. I think if you're doing it for the purposes I've done, you just got to get over that. But it's still the same thing as yours. Like, it's my business, and it's an asset to have.
I think that's the way to look at it. It's like, anyone that's writing out there should, like, don't think about writing for the sake of making money. Think about writing because it's something therapeutic or it's something you enjoy. And if you make money off the back of it, then that's going to be a great thing. But it shouldn't be your driving force, because you're probably going to be disappointed, and it will just make something stressful out of something that should just be like pure joy.
Great. We will leave it there.